Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Well,
sound beautiful this morning.
That is the illusory power of radio, ladies and gentlemen. We are now in week 3 of the KSFR Fun Drive, and we are almost done.
It won't be much longer.
And we have, a little under $15,000 left to raise.
That's my calculation this morning. That, of course, is unofficial. Linda Highheel will have the real number, but I think that's about right. And that means we could do it today. We could certainly do it tomorrow.
We'd rather do it today, wouldn't we? We would like to do it actually during this particular show that you were listening to.
Although Bill suggested to me on Friday we should just be all fundraising all the time.
You know, I do not agree with that suggestion, with great respect to Bill and his news gathering prowess.
Yeah, me either. I want to thank Brandon of Santa Fe for a very generous contribution a moment ago, and Shirley Hooper, who is a fan of yours, Mary Charlotte.
Shirley Hooper,
thank you very much. That's a good start to the hour. What are you doing this hour?
So we are doing two different things. We're going to be talking to Brian Fox Ellis, who is doing this incredible performance tonight. He is an unusual performer. He's going to be in Santa Fe. He gets into the characters of historical figures, often from science and nature studies of one kind or another, like John James Audubon, who he's going to be talking about in just a few minutes, or Charles Darwin, or people like that. And he does an evening performance in their persona, describing their ideas, but also having a lot of visuals, and he's doing bird calls and music and things like that. So that's who we have on first. And then second, we have on this incredible filmmaker who is standing by to talk to us from New York City. She's a cinematographer. She's one of the, I think, pretty few women in the American Society of Cinematographers, and she's made this great movie that's playing at the CCA called The Betrayal. You know what we haven't done yet? We haven't given the telephone number, which is 505-428-1393.
428-1393, or toll-free outside of the Santa Fe area, 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 1-866-907-5737. I also want to announce that just in, we made our $2,000 matching challenge in the first 2 hours of the morning.
Excellent.
Thank you all who called and helped us get that much closer to the final goal.
Let's have a challenge for this hour, just a straight challenge. What is our challenge number, Dal Dearman?
I'm thinking 1,500.
1,500. Ladies and gentlemen, help me and help KSFR.
You can do it. You've done it before.
And if we get $1,500 worth of contributions today, we will have made our challenge.
That's right.
So we're going to go to Brian Fox Ellis in just a moment, but the number is 505-428-1393. You know, for those who have been listening to this station for a while, maybe even for years, and who have never made that contribution, I just want to ask you to do it now, because when we go into week 3, I don't think we've had to do this before. When we go into week 3, it gets a little scary, because we think, where are our listeners? Are you really out there? We think you're listening. We're pretty sure you're listening. But how can you demonstrate that it's important to you? As we've said before, if you have a cable bill, you pay the cable bill. If you want to go to a movie, you buy the ticket. If you want to listen to KSFR, you just turn on the radio. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't actually work that way. You turn on the radio and you listen to it for 24, 25 weeks, and then you make a little contribution. And then you listen to it again for another 25 weeks. And then you make another little contribution. And that's how it works. It's easy. It's actually kind of fun to call, because there's nice people who take your pledge. And you can also choose among the many incredible items that you can get. As I've said before, my favorite is the KSFR brushed steel travel mug, which is really great. That you can get your to-go coffee in it, and you can use it at home, and it keeps your coffee warm and things like that. But any size contribution will get you some gift from KSFR, but the main gift is public radio. KSFR, Santa Fe Public Radio. And if you want it to keep going, well, just make your contribution now. We want to get $1,500 this hour. We want to get a whole bunch of phone calls. And so let's do it. 505-428-1393. And we're going to go now to Brian Fox Ellis. We'll be back in a little bit. I'd like now to introduce Brian Fox Ellis. He will be with us here in Santa Fe tonight at 7 o'clock at the boardroom at the Santa Fe Public Schools at 610 Alta Vista Street in Santa Fe, doing a performance called Adventures with Audubon. That's part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited about this evening's performance.
So you do storytelling of all kinds, a broad range of topics, including many varieties of nature and folklore. You're doing this one about John James Audubon. Tell us a little bit about Audubon's life.
Well, Audubon was, in many ways, one of the first totally gonzo American wild men. He would disappear into the woods for weeks or months at a time with little more than his paints and his brushes and his paper, his dog and his rifle, and he would live off the land and collect specimens of birds. More than a dozen species he was one of the first to scientifically describe and therefore got to name them for his friends, and was the first to paint every known species of bird in North America, 485 different species. It took him nearly 30 years. And every bird he painted, he also wrote a 5 to 10 page biography, what he called the ornithological biographies. So he's a fascinating character who was also a great writer, and so he's a lot of fun to impersonate because we know so much about him. He kept journals everywhere he went.
Originally, he was French, and he was a draft dodger. He came to the United States on a fake passport.
Well, he was born on the Isle of Santo Domingo, which today we call Haiti. His father was involved in the slave trade, and when the slaves of Haiti had an uprising, his father took him back to France, where he was raised. And then, yes, during the Napoleonic Wars, even though his father was an officer in the Navy, and I love to say maybe because his father was an officer in the Navy, he knew that not all war was just and did not want to lose his son to this, you know, egomaniacal Napoleon. And so he smuggled his son out of the country and set him up on a farm on Perkaman Creek near Philadelphia, which, you know, the Audubon family had owned for a while. Actually, John's father was friends with George Washington, and we must not forget the French helped us win our revolution before they had their own. And his father, you know, smuggled in military supplies for the American Revolution, helped to run the British blockade, and brought troops and mercenaries as well.
So Audubon got really interested in birds very early on. Do we know anything about it? I mean, it seems like it was clearly a life obsession.
When he was very young, he began to draw the birds of France, and he tells a couple of apocryphal stories about the possibility that maybe he studied with David in Paris as an artist, but it was when he came to America as a young man in 1803 that he really began to paint the birds of America in earnest. And there are several kind of funny stories about his early paintings. I love to say that, you know, at first, and in character, I would shoot a bird and I would lay it on the table and draw it as best as I could, but my early paintings looked like a dead bird lying on a table. So several times he would take his entire portfolio and throw it in the fire start again until he came up with his own unique method that was kind of a mix of taxidermy. You know, he'd shoot a bird and then wire it into the position he wanted. And then he would make like a pen and ink sketch. He would use watercolors for color. He was really what today you would call a multimedia artist. I mean, he used, you know, oils and watercolor and pen and ink and pencil and egg whites and whatever he could to get the right textures and colors for his gorgeous paintings.
It really reminds us that there was an era before photography where you couldn't do stop action, you know, photography, drawing. You actually had to kill the thing. You couldn't draw it from nature because it wouldn't sit still for long enough.
Right. All of his paintings are signed, or the prints, which is what he sold, you know, drawn from nature by John James Audubon. And that's because, you know, he did go out into the woods and he would collect the specimens. And you're exactly right. Without, you know, the kind of optics that we have today, there was no way he could create the kind of imagery and the detail. He drew not only every single feather, but on many of the birds, he drew every shaft and ray and barb and barbule of every feather. The detail is simply astounding.
And as a result, they're very much sought after today, and they are a pretty interesting combination of what we might call science and art.
Well, that's probably what he's most known for, that he was the first to kind of radically transform what we thought of as scientific illustration and to take it from, you know, the most boring, flat, lifeless scientific image to real art. And as he said, he was always trying to tell the story and capture the life of the bird, to capture the drama. And so I'm looking at the yellow-rumped warbler, which hangs in my office right here in front of me. And he drew the male, the female, and the immature. So it's scientifically accurate. You learn a lot about this warbler. But you can see the male and female kind of courting each other. And the male is perched on this beautiful iris. He was even invited to be the president of the American Botanical Society because there were dozens of new specimens of plants that were discovered in his paintings, because he paid so much attention to detail.
That's quite amazing. Now, the way he turned these out, it became a business for him. I mean, it's a business today, but it became a business for him within his own lifetime.
He struggled like many artists in his early years, but then he published this set, and you would buy a subscription. So every couple of months, you would get 5 prints, and eventually it was 435 prints in the complete double elephant portfolio. And admittedly, on those first sets, he barely broke even because they're so expensive to produce. But that's what made him famous, really earned his reputation. And then he produced what they call the Royal Octavo. Octavo is an 8, because you would get 8 prints on one large sheet of paper. And so those would be more like a regular coffee table book. And the Royal Octavo editions are where he made his fortune. And because his wife put up with him for all those years, he bought her 20 acres of Manhattan Island with the money made from that.
I guess the family didn't hold on to it.
No. He passed away, and she sold off parcels to help support herself in her final years, which is in part why the Audubon Society is named what it is, because she would tutor the children of wealthy neighbors as a way of supporting herself. And one of her students was George Bird Grinnell, who went on to become a famous Western artist. And George Bird Grinnell was instrumental in founding the Audubon Society. And it was because of him, in large part, that the Audubon Society got its name. Because, you know, as a little boy, he remembered hanging out in Audubon's house and looking at this gorgeous artwork. And that kind of inspired him to become an artist. And then when he was involved in trying to save endangered species of birds, he thought, what better but to name them for America's first great wildlife artist?
We're talking to Brian Fox Ellis, who will be performing tonight at 7 o'clock at the boardroom of the Santa Fe Public Schools at 610 Alta Vista Street here in Santa Fe. Just take a little break right now. The number here in the KSFR fund drive is 505-428-1393, 428-1393, and you can make your contribution to KSFR. We will be finished if you make your contribution now. We've been fundraising for a while, and we have to keep doing it until we reach our goal. And Brian Fox Ellis, are you a public radio listener?
Very much so, and I've been a member of most of the public radio stations in the towns where I have lived throughout my life. I love to tell this story. When I was teaching seventh grade in Charlotte, North Carolina, I was hired to teach science, which is my specialty, and I feel very qualified to do that. But then early in the first semester, the principal realized her numbers were off, and so she bumped me to social studies, which, being a storyteller and world traveler, she felt I could do, and I'd like to think I did an okay job, but it wasn't my specialty. And we studied Africa and Asia through seventh grade social studies, and it seemed like every day I'm driving to school, NPR had a piece on the country that I was going to be teaching that week.
That's funny.
So it became my blessing and my guide through the year. And really, you know, NPR does wonderful in-depth news and analysis of foreign news that we often miss in the American press. And so it was a great boon to me as an educator and for my class So I've always been a big fan and a member of stations in the various towns where I've lived over the years.
505-428-1393 is the number. 505-428-1393. If you're calling from out of area, you can call 1-866-907-5737. That's 1-866-907-KSFR. Make your contribution now, ladies and gentlemen. We do not want to be fundraising all year. We want to get it done with as soon as we possibly can. When you make your contribution, that means that shows like this mean something to you. And then we can go on to our regular programming. Let's return to Brian Fox Ellis and his work about John James Audubon. Audubon made, I mean, it is really extraordinary that somebody at the time he did, I mean, middle of the 19th century, a comprehensive catalog of the birds of North America. How much classification work had already been done? I mean, what was he using as his own sources to figure out what was, you know, when he got to the last one?
Well, that's a great question, because I've had a similar conversation around a different character. I also play Charles Darwin. And last time I was in Santa Fe was around Darwin's was the anniversary of Darwin's birthday, was, you know, earlier this year. And at that time, we weren't even sure what a species was. And Alexander Wilson was a Scottish immigrant who began painting the birds of America and died before he finished. And Wilson frequently made mistakes where, for example, you know, a yellow-rumped warbler, which I'm looking at here in my office, the difference between the male and female is somewhat stark, and the difference between the immature and mature, and the difference between the spring plumage when they're in mating colors and the fall plumage is also different. And so Wilson and some of the other ornithologists would think they had five different birds, when the truth is it was spring or fall or male or female or immature, all the same species. And so Audubon was meticulous in trying to carve out those differences. And I would say that he was an amazing taxonomist, because it was still relatively new. And yes, he did make a few minor errors, but considering that, you know, 485 species of birds, he was right many, many more times than he was wrong. So That's a great question, and that's one of the things that really fascinates me about Audubon, is he was a brilliant artist, he was an amazing scientist, and part of the performance, in all of my characterizations, I believe science is a verb, it's an activity, something you do, and so I engage the audience in scientific inquiry, where, for example, with the Darwin show, we're talking about geology of South America, and I show them the evidence, and they have to draw their own conclusions. With the Audubon show that I'll be doing tonight, there are several moments in the show where we talk about owls hearing, or about, you know, how do you know what feather this is? And I pose these questions to the audience and engage them in hands-on on scientific inquiry. But because that's how Audubon worked. I mean, these people were living scientists, and so I want to model that process as well. So it's also a fun interactive program in that regard.
Audubon was about a generation older than Charles Darwin. Did his work lay any of the groundwork that Darwin and other scientists built on?
Again, a great question, because in Darwin's Origin of Species, the work is almost entirely his own. Darwin was a fascinating man whose meticulous science is virtually irrefutable. But he mentions one scientist in the book twice. And that's John James Audubon. When Darwin was a young scientist working in London, he was a secretary of the Royal Geological Society, Audubon was a guest lecturer. And Darwin made comments on Audubon's lecture. And Audubon traveled in North America when this was wilderness and, you know, published articles in scientific journals in Europe. And I would like to believe that that might have had an inspiration on Darwin going to South America to collect new specimens and to kind of do this gonzo wilderness travel for several years. And so, yes, I do believe there was a very direct inspiration, and there's no doubt the two men met and talked, and that they, at least Darwin was familiar with Audubon's work, by the time Darwin was publishing, Audubon was getting on in years and actually suffered from dementia his final years. So I don't know that Audubon read Darwin, but we definitely know Darwin read Audubon.
Now, you just referred to Audubon as a scientist. Was he actually a scientist as well as an artist?
Yes. Unequivocally, yes. But you have to understand, in their day, there was no such thing as a trained professional scientist the way we think of it today. Most scientific discoveries were made by what today we'd call amateurs. But, you know, they did have training. They apprenticed with elders who taught them taxonomy. They participated in public debate and published articles. And so they were working scientists, though, you know, they didn't have the kind of university degrees that we would think of qualifications to be a scientist today. Darwin's degree was in divinity. He studied to be a minister.
And, that's right.
And science was more than a hobby, obviously, but in his early life, he thought it was just that, a hobby.
Now, I imagine you'll be showing some of the images of the birds during your performance.
Yeah, I travel with a museum-quality portfolio, some of the better prints. I actually have about 24 in my personal collection right now, and I don't always bring all of them, but I bring enough so the audience gets a real flavor for these double elephant portfolio images. Every bird Audubon painted was life size. And so I have a good variety from the tiniest hummingbird to the bald eagle, you know, songbirds, shorebirds, waterfowl.
Now,
I'm
of course,
also an avid birder. So.
Oh, okay. I mean, another part of this, of course, is that you are taking on the persona. So there's a real theatrical element to this. How did you develop Audubon's persona? I guess you had a lot to work with, but you still had to come up with his voice and his accent and his gestures.
Yeah, there's some wonderful descriptions of Audubon when he was in Europe trying to sell his art. He took on this persona of the American backwoodsman. Now, some historical scholars will claim that Mark Twain was the first American to create this persona of an American to help sell his writing. But I say that Audubon preceded him by a generation, and Audubon told apocryphal stories about squirrel hunting with Daniel Boone. And you also have to understand the historical context. James Fenimore Cooper was one of the most popular authors in Europe, the American, writing about the Last of the Mohicans and the American wilderness. James Fenimore Cooper was wildly popular in European circles. So Audubon rode that wave, and he came dressed in buckskin. He impersonated bird songs, which I also do in my performance. And so I have these extensive notes from Audubon about his programs that he delivered in Edinburgh, Scotland, and London, and Liverpool, and Paris, France. And so I'm kind of recreating that, you know, a little bit of a huckster showman who's telling these wonderful and very humorous stories about my travels in the wildest places in America to help kind of win over the audience, so hopefully they'll buy some of my art and I can support myself. and so it's a really fun program. And for me, probably the funnest thing is there's something for everybody. You know, if you know nothing about birds, I promise you'll learn something. But even, you know, PhD ornithologist, I've just last week was at a conference in Kearney, Nebraska for the crane migration. And, you know, even with PhD ornithologist, Audubon's writing has incredible depth, and they come away learning something as well. And, you know, like I've already mentioned, there's hands-on science. I play Name That Tune, where I impersonate bird songs. There's great art. I kind of set up this gallery on stage so the audience can kind of soak in this wonderful diversity of work.
So this is definitely a performance for all ages. It's tonight at 7 o'clock in the boardroom of the Santa Fe Public Schools. That's at 610 Alta Vista Street in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 603-7468. Brian Fox Ellis, it's just been great having you on the air, and we look forward to seeing you tonight.
Great. And I will just close by saying I'm sponsored this evening by the Science Cafe, which this is the second time they've hosted one of my programs. And it's a wonderful organization that sponsors an ongoing series of kind of community dialogues with the wealth of scientific wisdom that's in the Santa Fe area. And then occasionally they bring in outside guests like me. So,
yeah, we do them on the – we do just about everybody who's on the – who's doing an event is on this show. So we want to thank Bob Eisenstein, who's really made it all happen.
Yes.
And thanks to you, Brian Fox Ellis.
Great.
And you're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Brian Fox Ellis. It's a free presentation tonight. It should be great. The number here at the fund drive is 505-428-1393. Now, here's a way to think of it. This is a free event that people can go to tonight. They can bring their kids, they can go by themselves and just be the inner kid that they are. And instead of doing something that costs money tonight, make that donation right now to KSFR, 505-428-1393.
That is a great idea. Our good friend Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute called a little while ago.
Yay.
And wanted to offer some additional Laurie Anderson tickets.
Oh, my goodness.
Laurie Anderson coming to the Lenzic on Monday, June 8th. A pair of tickets for $100 during the program this morning. And on Tuesday the 9th, the morning afterwards at the Lenzic, there's a Q&A with Laurie Anderson. And there are 10 tickets, thanks to Diane, available to us for the fund drive at $25 each to participate in the Q&A with Laurie Anderson. So that's two great events. Monday the 8th of June at the Lenzic, a pair of tickets for Laurie Anderson, $100 to KSFR. And on Tuesday the 9th at the Lenzic, a Q&A with Laurie Anderson at 11 a.m., $25 each. We have only 10 tickets, though, so we need you to call now, 428-1393, 428-1393. And We have set a goal for ourselves of $1,500 this hour, the Monday Radio Cafe. I don't think we're quite...
We're not even close.
No, we're not even close.
Ladies and gentlemen, scientists, naturalists, lovers of birds, lovers of animals.
Lovers of Mary Charlotte.
And of KSFR. Give a call to 505-428-1393 and make a pledge so that we can get this fun drive over and done with. We've been doing very well. I want to thank everybody who already has pledged. Many, many, many people.
Thank you, Patrick McGinn, for calling moments ago. Patrick,
yay,
thanks
thank
a lot.
Thank you. Wonderful. And for those of you who haven't called yet, just do it now, because guess what? We're going to be here till we reach our goal. We are very close to it. We're, what, 90% of the way there?
Yeah, we are 90% of the way there. We could finish today. We certainly could finish tomorrow. We'd like to finish today, and it's up to you. Once we get to the $126,000 total goal, we will quit that very second. We will not linger one moment with the fund drive. Back to regular programming within moments.
And honestly, I can't wait. So, you know what? Make it happen. Give a call, 505-428-1393. We're going to take a 30-second break right now, and we will be back in a moment to talk to our next guest. Please make that call, and please stay tuned. And once again, back at the KSFR fund drive, once again, the number 505-428-1393. 505-428-1393. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by phone, Ellen Kuras. She is an award-winning cinematographer, and she is the director, writer, and co-producer of the film The Betrayal, which is screening right now at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. How are you? I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. I was just blown away by your film. It's a documentary that is looking at the life of a family from Laos, and it's a very personal story, and it's also a very political story about the role of Laos. I didn't even know any of this in the Vietnam War. Laos was a neutral country, and yet because of the United States' participation in the Vietnam War, a lot of bombs got dropped on Laos. What was going on there?
Well, basically, we were using Laos as a jumping-off point to fight along the North Vietnamese along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we weren't allowed to have ground troops in Laos, so we ended up going by air and conducting a massive secret air war, which today is still unofficially recognized. The United States has not recognized that we fought a war in Laos, even though we dropped millions of tons of bombs there. And in fact, Laos was the most bombed country in the world, World War II and World War I combined, until just recently when we dropped more bombs in Iraq.
Oh, my goodness. And so this is a story that hasn't really been told or understood. And it's the first betrayal in this film, which is called The Betrayal, which is a story of a Laotian family. The father was in the military, and he ended up collaborating with the Americans, bombing his own country, essentially, on behalf of the Americans. And then when the war was over, he and everybody like him was abandoned, and he was a prisoner of war in his own country. And it goes on from there. The mother and her 10 children moved to the United States.
Exactly. And what happened in Laos is that, you know, we basically recruited those guys to fight our war for us because we couldn't be on the ground. So people like Tavi's father were recruited by the CIA to do our work for us. And basically when we left, we didn't even tell them that we were leaving. And we ended up leaving them high and dry. So, what you know, the fallout from that was that people like Tavi's family and his mother were blacklisted in the country when the communists took over, and therefore they had to make decisions about whether they were going to stay or whether they were going to leave in the absence of the father.
Now, Tavi is the main character in this film, Tavisu Prasavat, and you met him and his family when they landed in Brooklyn in the mid-1980s. How did you meet them, and how did you start filming them?
Well, you know, this film actually started in Rochester, New York. There's a significant Lao population in Rochester where I had been going to the visual studies workshop. I'm a cinematographer, and I had started making this film about this one group of Laotians. And this is going back into 1984. So when I moved back to New York in 1985, I was still trying to make this film, and I realized that in order to understand people and a culture better, in order to have like an inside point of view of the way that the people think about their worldview, about the how they think about the world and their philosophy, I really needed to learn how to speak the language. So I put the word out in the Brooklyn community that I wanted to learn how to speak Lao, and Tavi called me one day, and he was kind of, you know, in awe and saying, like, who are you? And do you even know where Laos is? And, you know, why do you want to learn my language? And thereafter, we struck up this incredible friendship where he would come to my house twice a week and he would teach me how to speak Lao. And it gave me an opportunity to be able to talk with him and to ask him many questions about stories and what he remembered from his grandmother and the idea of Lao mythology. Because early in my career, in my studies at Brown, I was very much interested in Native American mythology and the death of a spirit because of the loss of land and the idea of living in exile in one's own country. And so, you know, the Native American example was very alive in me, and I wanted to be able to see if I could make this analogy to the Lao of coming from another country and living in exile in another country. And what does that do to a people? And what does that do to their spirit? And so Tavi had a wealth of stories. And these stories, I realized, really connected not only with Tavi as a person, as a child of war, but with me and with all of us. You know, part of the film begins with saying, it says, 5,000 years ago, the ancient Lao said, the time will come when the universe will break. It will break piece by piece, country by country, religion by religion. Husband and wife will break into two. The husband and wife will separate, and the children will escape, running to hide like frightened deer hunted by evil men. And the new world will not be what we've always known it. And so, you know, these prophecies that Tavi remembered and that were written down from the Lao through oral history struck me as being the cornerstones of the film and reminding us as people of our destiny and our role here in the world.
We're talking to Ellen Kuros about the film The Betrayal, which is screening at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, while we are taking just a very tiny break now, please call the fund drive number 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393. Ellen, this family, they landed in Brooklyn, and the contrast, which you shoot so beautifully, you're an amazing cinematographer. You have footage from Laos, and you have footage from Brooklyn, and one incredibly beautiful, and the other pretty awful. And that sense of cultural loss and not being able to have the tools to handle that loss of cultural roots, especially when what's come in is really not very nice or not very nurturing. That's something that the whole family really exemplifies. Some of the kids go down paths that aren't so great.
Well, you know, what happens in the film is that we see that the initial betrayal of our country to their country filters all the way down to what happens in the family and betrayal of the family from the United States when they come here, the family expecting to be taken care of because they were our allies. And we see through the film how it moves from being a political story into a very intimate personal story of family bonds. And to me, that's where it resonates very importantly about how war affects us on a very personal level. And because I shot this film over 20 years, I worked on this film for 23 years in the course, in between making many other films for other people, you know, one sees the trajectory of history, and we see the history of the family and how war really never ends for these people and really never ends for us because they are our neighbors. And so, it's interesting to see in the film that I'm able to take beautiful visuals of Laos and use them as metaphor. And when we first open up in the film, we see these two children playing on the water buffaloes in the sunset in a pond. And, you know, we realize that, oh, it's very beautiful, and we hear the prophecy of, you know, the demise of our universe. But then later on, it's very interesting because those kids, in a way, represent Tavi in his childhood, and Tavi being an innocent child before he left his country. And then in the end of the film, when we go back to seeing those children again, it's a very different feeling that one gets. We understand that, you know, that Tavi is not innocent and that war is not innocent. And so in a way, the visuals I hope to use as telling their own story, and in that case, the story of innocence. And throughout the film, you know, the visuals really do tell their own story. And I think that's kind of shaped my career as a cinematographer where, you know, in all of my films, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Below, I shot Andy Warhol, Summer of Sam, which I did with Spike. You know, I look for meaning. I look for meaning in the images, and I try to show and convey meaning in images. And this film, The Betrayal, is where that all started.
Very much so. It's so incredibly skillfully done in that respect. And as you say, it really makes you think about the relationship between seemingly unrelated acts of violence, namely, you know, gangs in the United States and then wars in distant countries. But the way that those things come together is made so clear, but it's not didactic. You sort of put it together yourself as the viewer of the film.
Well, that's always the most difficult thing about making a film, is how do you tell the political through the personal and the personal through the political? I mean, that was one of the challenges of making the film over the years, was that, you know, I didn't want the film to be a history lesson. And, you know, it's a film, and that's what distinguishes it from writing an essay or writing a paper. You know, the reason why it took a long period of time was the first 10 years of trying to make the film, which is a film about memory and a film about, you know, the place where one comes from as well as the war and a place and the sense of where they are now, is that Laos was closed for the first 10 years of making the film. It was a closed country. It was the Lao People's Democratic Republic, and all the doors were closed to the outside world. And it wasn't until perestroika in Russia and that in China things started opening up, that the doors started opening and people could go back to visit. The human rights record is still not entirely clear in Laos, even today, you know, which is kind of interesting because we look at Laos and we see it on the number one tourist spot of the New York Times, you know, travel section. Yet for the Laotians, it's a much different story about the hesitation to go back to a country where it's still, where they're still considered traitors. And So, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, we're talking to Ellen Kuras about the film The Betrayal. Well, I was wondering also, I mean, filming a group of people over 23 years is extremely unusual, and obviously a real relationship developed with the family, and I was amazed how you, the filmmaker, were so invisible. You really don't draw any attention to yourself at all. But how did it affect, if it did, the individual members of the family, besides Tavi, to be continually filmed by that? Did they reflect on their lives differently because of your presence, do you think?
I think that for the family at large, they were just used to me being there. I became a family member. You know, in the many times that that I would be able to go and stay with the family or visit them. In fact, I would often see them more than my own family. But, you know, in between making many films and commercials, I took whatever time I could to go and spend with them, which is why I happened to be there for certain key moments in the family drama. But I think the person who was most effective was Tavi. And in the course of being with me and joining me in making the film and being the subject of the film, you know, the film was like his school. And he learned, you know, how to be a filmmaker, if you will. You know, and that was one of the things I felt was very important, is to share the skills of filmmaking so that he, as a Laotian, could go on and make films about his own people or make films as himself. And I think it's really important that we share the means of production, if you will. Right. And he was most affected by it. I think that the film enabled him an outside point of view of his own life and enabled him to deal with some of the circumstances that happened. But very much, you know, we were very close, and he was, in a way, the doorway into the Lao world for me, as I was to the Western world for him. And, you know, I mean, it was very interesting because I was kind of struck by bringing him into the NBC to watch archival footage of his own people and the signing of the independence declaration from French colonialism, for the first time, for him to witness his own family history, his own Laotian history, where I would say most Laotians will never, ever get a chance to see any of that, was really great for me to be able to share that with him.
So he now, after all this time, has become a filmmaker thanks to you, and this 23-year project is over. That's a real kind of graduation for you to have something like this finished with that you've been doing for so very long. What's that like?
Oh, my gosh, believe me. You know, I mean, I finally feel free where I can read a book without feeling guilty. I should be doing something. But, yeah, you know, I mean, Tommy actually describes it. He says, you know, this film has been like a child. And, you know, when they get into high school, you're like, okay, get ready, because you're going to have to go out the door. And then when they graduate from college, it's like, okay, now is the time. Go out and get a job. Right. And finally, it was like, okay, now is the time. You have to go out into the world and be on your own. And for me, I realized it was the time to finish the film and to go back to it, because there was about a 4 or 5 year period where we didn't work on the film at all because I was very busy making feature films. And when I make a feature film, I usually, my life is, you know, 6 months into making a film. I mean, from beginning to end. And I have no time, and, you know, to do anything else while I'm shooting a film. So I decided that I had to say no to some significant projects. You know, like Jim Sheridan wanted me to shoot a film of his, and Sidney Pollack, the late Sidney Pollack, before he died. And I realized that it was time. The war in Iraq was getting ridiculous. And I realized that people need to see the story now, because this is so relevant to what's going on now in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And we need to know what happens, and we need to know our own history. And so that's why I just said, you know, we have to go back and finish. And I called up Tavi and I said, let's start up the project again and let's finish it. And it was his mother who really rounded out the whole project. We interviewed her, and she is incredible. I mean, I never expected that she would be able to give, in a way, her own, the greatest real-life performance that I've ever witnessed. I mean, she really is so powerful and so profound.
Yes, very much so.
And I myself felt very attached to her. And I really, you know, I think that everybody should see the film to, you know, to hear what Tavi's mother has to say.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's sadness, wisdom, and an experience of leaving one's country and leaving one's roots that I think can, even if you're born and raised in Santa Fe and have never even been to Albuquerque, still it touches you in some way that's unexpected and incredible.
Well, that's the same thing for me. I mean, this film is as much my story as everybody in the United States or anybody in the world for that matter, because there's global migration going on. But for me, I always felt attached to it, not only because of the Native American connection, because it's very strong about the loss of spirit in the lack of having a homeland, a true homeland, and the lack of, you know, the sense of a lost identity. And how does one derive identity? But for me, my grandfather came over at the turn of the century from Eastern Europe, and he wanted to find the American dream and didn't. I mean, he lost all of his money in the recession, in the Depression, actually, and he wanted to go back. But he wasn't able to go back because by then Poland was a communist country, and he wasn't able to go back. And the feeling of that extreme loneliness and that sense of detachment from oneself, where one identifies oneself to the earth, was so profound that it ran through our family to me as a small child. And, you know, and I felt like that's part of the spirit that comes through in the film, is that sense of, you know, how do we identify ourselves and where do we feel most at home?
Ellen Quiroz is the filmmaker who made the film The Betrayal. She's the director, writer, and co-producer along with Tavisuk Prasavat, and it's screening at the CCA. It's an amazing film. Ellen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Thanks, and bravo for NPR.
And thank you. Yeah, make a are you a public radio listener in New
York?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah, I live on public radio. When I go to Europe, I'm dying because I always miss my public radio.
There you have it. Make a phone call now, 505-428-1393, and we'll see you soon, Ellen Quiroz.
Great. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks to you.
Bye-bye.
Just a couple of minutes left, and I have a feeling that we have not even come close to making our goal this
hour. I am sad to report that we have not, no.
Ladies and gentlemen, step it up. 505-428-1393. We really don't want to be fundraising
for
a whole lot longer.
We're at that point toward the end of the fund drive when people become a little bit exhausted, a little bit worn, both here and out there in among our listeners. And it's just time to, as you say, step it up just a little while longer because we're so close to making our goal. We could end this fund drive today, and we'd all be just so excited about that. Back to regular programming tomorrow. It's possible. It's possible.
Hey, the phone just rang.
There you go.
Let's
we need
get
some
all
more of those.
Three of them ringing. We have wonderful people eating large masses of saturated fat and
more
sugar products.
More than they should be. Are you having bacon?
I will be momentarily, ladies and gentlemen, here in the Santa Fe Bacon Company.
Another long-standing tradition.
Yes, we are broadcasting live from this wonderful institution, and we are asking you to make a phone call. For those of you who haven't done it yet, do it now. And for those of you who haven't seen this film, go see this film. It's really incredible. I think I'm going to go see it on the big screen just to have the opportunity to look at the cinematography. This is the kind of thing that you hear about on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It sounds great. It really does.
It's really unbelievable film. As you heard, she's an filmmaker who's shot some of the great famous Hollywood movies, and it's interesting. I mean, she shot Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and she shot all sorts of analyzed that and movies that maybe you've seen, but here we are in Santa Fe. Pardon me?
It was a fun interview.
It was a fun interview, but here we are in Santa Fe, and we have the chance to see the project of the heart and soul of somebody who is such an incredible cinematographer. But, you know, everybody has some project which is their life's work. This is it for her. You get to hear it on KSFR. And are you willing to say thanks for that? If you are, here's how you do it. You call 505-428-1393. You talk to one of the very nice people. You say, oh, I just want to thank KSFR for letting me have these opportunities. And then you give $10 a month or $35.
Whatever you can afford.
$1,000, whatever you can afford, anywhere in between or higher. If you can afford $5, you know what? I've written to some people, say, hey, you're going to give during this fund drive. And they say, oh, man, I can't give more than 10. I said, great.
Fine, sure.
Be counted with those $10 because we are going to get to our goal. And the sooner you call, the better. I'd rather have 10 people giving $10 each. Okay, that's a $100 contribution. And then a $100 contribution, then just the one. Because that means that those 10 people actually said, you know what, this means something to me. 505-428-1393. I want to thank Dal Dearman, who I'm talking to right now, General Manager of KSFR, for all the incredible work he's doing, not only during the fund drive, but during the whole rest of the year to keep this station on the air and to deal with the many personalities of all the crazy people and eccentrics who make up public radio.
Everybody loves somebody sometimes.
You sound like Robert Knott.
Yeah.
Anyway, 505-428-1393. So send your special thanks to Dal Dearman, who's just a wonderful leader and wonderful person in our community.
I can use the money.
We can all use the money.
We can all use the money.
But most of all, we can use what KSFR has to give, which is thoughtful, intelligent, and interesting, up-to-date public radio. It feeds your soul. It feeds your spirit. It feeds your intellect. Do it now.
This really is one of the great public radio stations in the country.
And you've been around. You've been around to hear a lot of them. You've been to many cities, probably many more than I have.
I've been around, kid.
Here in the United States. Well, I got to go now. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. I want to thank Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. She's an incredible engineer. And stay tuned for...
And so much more during the fund drive. Marilyn's been doing a great, great job every morning here.
She's the most on-the-ball engineer.
Everybody loves her.
Thank you.
Yes. And stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that...
Lauren Camp.
428-1393. Gotta go. Hasta la vista. Thanks, Dal. Thanks, Mary Lynn. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Ciao.